Welcome to this Uvula audio production of Aunts Are Not Gentlemen by P.G. Wodehouse.
Volume 6, Chapter 18. I should have to check with Jeeves, but I think the word to describe the way I slept that night was fitfully. I turned and twisted like an adagio dancer, and no wonder, for what I've heard Jeeves call the fell clutch of circumstance, which was clutching me, was not ordinarily felt clutch that can be wriggled out of by some simple ruse, such as going on a voyage round the world and not showing up again till things had blown over. I had the option, of course, of dissociating myself entirely from the cat sequence and refusing to have anything more to do with the ruddy animal. But this would mean Colonel Briscoe scratching Simler's nomination, which would mean that a loved aunt would lose a packet and have to touch Uncle Tom to make up the deficit, which would mean upsetting the latter's gastric juices for one didn't know how long, which would mean him pushing his plate away untasted night after night, which would make Anatole, temperamental like all geniuses, getting deeply offended and handing in his resignation. Ruin, desolation, and despair were all around, in short. Manifestly, the chivalry of the Worcesters could not permit all that to happen. Somehow, whatever the perils involved, the cat had to be decanted somewhere where it could find its way back to his GHQ. But who was to do the decanting? Billy Graham had made it plain that no purse of gold, however substantial, could persuade him to brave the horrors of Eggersford Court, that sinister house. Jeeves had formally declared himself a non-starter, and Aunt Dahlia was disqualified by her unfortunate inability to move from spot to spot without having twigs snap beneath her feet. This put the issue squarely up to Bertram, and no chance for him to do a nolle prosequi, because if he did, bang went his hopes, for quite a time at least, of enjoying Anatole's cooking. It was consequently in a sombre mood that I went across to the Goose and Gander for breakfast. I do not, as a rule, take the morning meal at 6:30, but I had been awake since 4, and the pangs of hunger could be resisted no longer. If there was one thing I had taken for granted, it was that I would be breakfasting alone. My surprise, therefore, at finding Orlo in the dining-room tucking into eggs and bacon was considerable. I couldn't imagine how he came to be in circulation at such an hour. Bird-watchers, of course, are irregular in their habits, but even if he had an appointment with a Clarkson's warbler, you would have expected him to have made it for much nearer lunch.
"Oh, hello, Bertie. Glad to see you."
"You're up early, Orlo."
"A little before my usual time. I don't want to keep Vanessa waiting."
"You've asked her to breakfast?"
"No, she will have had breakfast. Our date was for 7:30. She may, of course, be late. It depends on how soon she can find the key to the garage."
"Why does she want the key to the garage?"
"To get the Bentley."
"Why does she want the Bentley?"
"My dear Bertie, we've got to elope in something."
"Elope?"
"I ought to have explained that earlier. Yes, we're eloping. And thank goodness we've got a fine day for it. Ah, here are your eggs. You'll enjoy them. They're very good at the Goose and Gander. Come, no doubt, from contented hens."
On seating myself at the table, I had ordered eggs, and as he justly observed, they were excellent. But I dug into them listlessly. I was too bewildered to give them the detached thought they deserved. "Do you mean to say that you and Vanessa are eloping?"
"The only sober, sensible course to pursue. This comes as a surprise to you?"
"You could knock me down with a ham sandwich."
"What seems to be puzzling you?"
"I thought you weren't on speaking terms." His response was a guffaw like a hyena. It was plain that he was feeling his oats to no little extent, quite naturally, of course. Vanessa being the tree on which the fruit of his life hung, as I have heard it described. It made me reflect on the extraordinary extent to which tastes can differ. I, as I have shown, though momentarily attracted by her radiant beauty, had frozen in every limb at the prospect of linking my lot with hers, whereas he was obviously all for it. In just the same way, my Uncle Tom dances around in circles if he can get hold, at enormous expense, of a silver overformed chocolate pot of the Queen Anne period, which I wouldn't be seen in public with. Curious. He continued to guffaw.
"You aren't up to the minute with your society gossip, Bertie. That's all a thing of the past. Admittedly, relations were at one time strained and harsh words spoken about the colour of my liver. But we had a complete reconciliation last night.
Oh, you met with her last night?
Shortly after I left you. She was taking a stroll, preparatory to going to bed, and bedewing her pillow with salt tears.
Why should she do that?
Because she was going to marry you.
I see. The fate that is worse than death, you might say.
Exactly.
Sorry she was troubled.
Quite all right. She soon got over it when I told her I had been seeing Cook and demanding my money. When she heard that I had several times thumped the table, her remorse for having called me a sleeked, cowering, timorous beastie was pitiful. She compared me with heroes of old Greek legend, to their disadvantage, and to cut a long story short, flung herself into my arms.
She must have got wet.
Very wet. But she didn't mind. An emotional girl wouldn't.
I suppose not.
We then decided to elope. You may be wondering what we're going to live on, but with my salary and a bit of money she has from the will of an aunt, we shall be all right. So it was arranged that she should have an early breakfast, go to the garage, pinch the Bentley, and put the other cars out of action, leaving Cook for pursuing purposes only the gardener's Ford.
Well, that ought to fix him.
I think so. It's an excellent car for its purpose, but scarcely adapted to chasing daughters across country. Cook will never catch us with it.
Though I don't see what he could do, even if he did catch up with you.
You don't? What about that hunting crop of his?
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. I don't know if he would have developed this theme, but before he could speak, there came from the street a musical tooting.
Ah, there she is,
he said, and out he went. And so did I. I had no wish to meet Vanessa. I slid out the back door and returned to Wee Nook, and I had picked up by order of the Tsar and was hoping to discover what it was that he had ordered, my bet being that a lot of characters with the names ending in ski would be off to Siberia before they knew what had hit them. Then who should enter hurriedly but Orlo? He had an envelope in his hand.
Ah, there you are, Bertie. I can only stop a minute. Vanessa's out in the car.
Ask her to come in.
She won't come in. She says it would be too painful for you.
What would?
Meeting her, you ass. Gazing on her when you knew she is another's.
Oh, yes, I see.
No sense in giving yourself a lot of agony if you don't have to.
Oh, quite.
I wouldn't have disturbed you, only I wanted to give you this letter. It's a note I've written to Cook in place of the one Vanessa wrote last night.
Oh, she wrote him a note?
Yes.
To be pinned to her pincushion?
That was the idea. But she dropped it somewhere and couldn't be bothered to hunt around for it, so I thought I'd better send him a line. If you're running away with a man's daughter, it's only civil to let him know, and I will put the facts before him much better than she would. Women are apt not to stick to the point when writing letters. With the best intentions in the world, they ramble and embroider. A university-trained man like myself, who contributes to the New Statesman, does not fall into this blunder. He is concise. He is lucid.
I didn't know you wrote for the New Statesman.
Occasional letters to the editor, and I rarely fail to enter for the weekly competitions.
Absorbing work?
Very.
I'm a writer of sorts myself. When my Aunt Dahlia was running that paper of hers, Milady's Boudoir, I did a piece on it. What the Well-Dressed Man is Wearing.
Did you indeed? Next time we meet, you must tell me all about it. Can't stop now. Vanessa's waiting, and...
He added as the tooting of the horn broke the morning stillness.
Getting impatient. Here's the letter.
You want me to take it to Cook?
What do you think I wanted you to do with it? Get it framed?
And so saying, he legged it like a nymph, surprised while bathing, and I picked up my By Order of the Tsar. As I did so, I was thinking bitterly that I wished the general public would stop regarding me as an uncomplaining hey you, on whom all the unpleasant jobs could be shoveled. Whenever something sticky was afoot and action had to be taken, the cry was sure to go up, let Worcester do it. I have already touched on my Aunt Agatha's tendency to unload her foul son Thomas on me at all seasons. My Aunt Dahlia had blotted the sunshine from my life in the matter of the cat. And here was Orlo Porter cooling telling me to take the letter to Cook, as if entering Cook's presence in his present difficult mood wasn't much the same as joining Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of whom I had read when I won that Scripture Knowledge Prize at my private school, on their way to the burning fiery furnace. What, I asked myself, was to be done? It was a dilemma which might well have baffled a lesser man, but the whole point about the Worcesters is that they are not lesser men. I don't suppose it was more than 3/4 of an hour before the solution flashed on me, viz., to write Cook's name and address on the envelope, stick a stamp on it, and post it. Having decided to do this, I returned to my reading. But everything seemed to conspire today to prevent me from making any real progress with my Order of the Tsar. Scarcely had I perused a paragraph when the door burst open, and I found that I was seeing Cook after all. He was standing on the threshold, looking like the Demon King in a pantomime. And with him was Major Plank!
Chapter 19.
I've always rather prided myself on being a good host, putting visitors at their ease with debonair smiles and courteous wisecracks. But I'm compelled to admit that at the sight of these two, I didn't come within a mile of achieving this. And the best I could do in the way of wisecracks was a hoarse cry like that of a Pekingese with laryngitis. It was left to Plank to get the conversation going.
"We're in luck, Cook,"
he said.
"They haven't started yet, because if they had..."
He added, reasoning closely,
"the Bounder wouldn't be here, would he?"
"You're right,"
said Cook. Then addressing me,
"Where's my daughter, you scoundrel?"
"Yes, where is she, you rat?"
said Plank. And I suddenly came all over calm. From being a Pekingese with throat trouble, I turned in a flash into one of those fellows in historical novels who flick a speck of dust from the irreproachable Mechlin lace at their wrists, preparatory to making the bad guys feel like pieces of cheese. Because with my quick intelligence, I had spotted that the parties of the second part had got all muddled up, and that I was in a position to score off them, as few parties of the second part had ever been scored off. "Fill me in on 2 points, Messieurs Plank and Cook, if you will be so good," I said. "A, why are you taking up space in my cottage, which I require for other purposes? And B, what the hell are you talking about? What is all this song and dance about daughters?"
"Trying to brazen it out,"
said Plank.
"I told you he would. He reminds me of a man I knew in East Africa who always tried to brazen things out. If you caught him with his fingers in a cigar box, he would say he was just tidying the cigars. Fellow named Abercrombie Smith, eventually eaten by a crocodile on the lower Zambezi. Even he had to give up when confronted with overwhelming evidence. Confront this blighter with overwhelming evidence, Cook."
"I will,"
said Cook, producing an envelope from his pocket.
"I have here a letter from my daughter, signed Vanessa."
"A very important point,"
said Plank.
"I will read it to you. Dear father, I'm going away with the man I love."
"Let's see him wriggle out of that,"
said Plank.
"Yes, what do you have to say?"
demanded Cook. "Merely this," I riposted. I was thinking how mistaken Orlo had been in asserting that girls rambled when writing letters. Anything more lucid and concise than this one I'd never come across. Possibly I felt Vanessa, too, was a contributor to the New Statesman. "Cook," I said, "you're laboring under a... what do you call it?"
"See,"
said Plank.
"Didn't I say he would try to brazen it out?"
"That letter does not refer to me."
"Are you denying that you're the man my daughter loves?"
"That's just what I'm denying."
"In spite of the fact she's always in and out of this beastly cottage, and is probably at this moment hiding under the bed in the spare room?"
said Plank, continuing to shove his oar in the most unnecessary manner. These African explorers have no tact, no reticence. "May I explain," I said. "The chap you're looking for is Orlo Porter. They fell for each other when she was in London, and love has been burgeoning ever since, if burgeoning means what I think it means. Anyway, until they felt they could no longer bear separation. So she pinched your car and they've driven off together to the registrar's. It didn't go well. Cook said I was lying, and Plank said of course I was, adding that the more he saw of me, the more he was reminded of Abercrombie Smith, who, he said, would undoubtedly have done a long stretch in the chokey if the crocodile hadn't taken things into its own hands.
I should have mentioned that in the course of these exchanges, Cook's complexion had been steadily deepening. It now looked like a Drones Club tie, which is a rich purple. There was talk at one time of having it crimson with white spots, but the supporters of that view were outvoted.
How dare you have the insolence to suppose I'm fool enough to believe that story, that my daughter is in love with Orlo Porter?
He thundered.
As if any girl in her senses would love Orlo Porter.
It's ridiculous,
said Plank.
Vanessa would turn in disgust from him.
On her heel,
said Plank.
What she can see in you, I can't imagine.
Nor can I,
said Plank.
He's got a beard like one of those Victorian novelists. Revolting spectacle.
It was true I hadn't shaved this morning, but this was going too far. I don't mind criticism, but I will not endure vulgar abuse. Phooey, I said. It's an expression I don't often use, but Nero Wolfe is always saying it with excellent results, and it seemed to fit in rather well here. Enough of this back chat. Read this, I said, handing Cook Orlo's letter. I must say, his reception of what Plank would have called the overwhelming evidence was all that could be desired. His jaw fell, he snorted, his face crumpled up like a sheet of carbon paper.
Good God!
He gurgled.
What is it?
Asked Plank.
What's the matter?
This is from Porter, saying he's eloped with Vanessa.
It's probably a forgery.
No, Porter's writing is unmistakable.
He choked.
Mr. Worcester.
Don't call him Mr. Worcester as if he were a respectable member of society,
said Plank.
He's a desperate criminal who once came within an ace of stinging me for £5. He's known to the police as Alpine Joe. Address him as that. Worcester's only a pen name.
Cook didn't seem to be listening. I didn't blame him.
Mr. Worcester, I owe you an apology.
I decided to temper justice with M. No sense in grinding the poor old buster beneath the iron heel. True, he had been extremely offensive, but in a man who has lost his daughter and his cat within a day or two of each other, it must be excused. Don't give it another thought, my dear fellow, I said. We all make mistakes. I forgive you freely. If this little misunderstanding has taught you not to speak till you are sure of the facts, it will have been time well spent. I had paused, speculating as to whether I wasn't being a bit too patronizing, when somebody said meow in a low voice, and looking down I saw that the cat had strolled in. And if ever a cat chose the wrong moment, forgetting the party spirit and wanting to mix in with the boys, this cat was that cat. I looked at it with a wild surmise, as silent as those bimbos on the peak in Darien, with both hands pressed to the top of my head to prevent it from taking to itself the wings of a dove and soaring to the ceiling, I asked myself what the harvest would be. I was speedily informed on this point.
Ha!
Said Cook, scooping up the animal and pressing it to his bosom. He seemed to have lost all interest in eloping daughters.
I told you it must have been Alpine Joe who was the kidnapper,
said Plank.
That was why he was hanging about the stables that day. He was waiting his chance.
Biding his time.
And he hasn't a word to say for himself.
And he was right. I was unable to utter. I couldn't clear myself by exposing the aged relative at the bar of world opinion. I couldn't make them believe that I was going to return the cat. You might have described me as being trapped in a net of fate if you had happened to think of the expression. And when that happens to you, it's no use saying anything. Ask the boys at Dartmoor or Pentonville. I can only trust that joy at recovering his lost one might soften Cook's heart and make him let me off lightly. Not a hope.
I shall insist on an exemplary sentence,
he said.
And meanwhile,
said Plank, in that offensively officious way of his,
shall I be hitting him on the head with my stick? The Zulu knob carry would be better, but I left it up at the house.
I was going to ask you to go for policemen.
While you do what?
While I take the cat back to Potato Chip.
Suppose, while we're both gone, he does a bunk.
You have a point there.
When anyone is caught stealing in Bongo on the Congo, they tie him down on an anthill until they can get hold of the Walla Walla, as judges are called in the native dialect. Makes it awkward for the accused if he isn't fond of ants, and the Walla Walla is away for the weekend. But into each life some rain must fall, and he ought to have thought of that before he started pinching things. We're short of ants, of course, but we can tie him to the sofa. It only means pulling down a couple of curtain cords.
Then by all means, let us do as you suggest.
Better gag him. We don't want him yelling for help.
My dear Plague, you think of everything.
I'm a great reader of novels of suspense, and I had often wondered how the heroes of them felt when the heavy tied them up, as he generally did about halfway through. I was now in a position to get a rough idea, but of course only a rough one, for they are pretty nearly always attached to a barrel of gunpowder with a lit candle on top, which must have made the whole thing considerably more poignant. I've been spared this what you might call added attraction, but even so, I was far from being in a sunny mood. I think it was the gag which contributed most to the lowering of my spirits. Plank had inserted his tobacco pouch between my upper and lower teeth, and it tasted far too strongly of African Explorer to be agreeable. It was a great relief when I heard a footstep and realized that Jeeves had returned from reveling with Mrs. P.B. Piggott of Balmoral, Mafeking Road.
"Good morning, sir,"
he said. He expressed no surprise at seeing me tied to a sofa with curtain cords, just as he would have E no S if he had seen me being eaten by a crocodile at the late Abercrombie Smith, though in the latter case he might have heaved a regretful sigh. Assuming I would prefer to be without them, he removed the gag and unfastened my bonds.
"Have you breakfasted, sir?"
he asked. I told him I had.
"Perhaps some coffee, sir?"
"Great idea, and make it strong," I said, hoping it would wash out the taste of Plank's tobacco pouch. "And when you return, I shall a tale unfold which will make you jump as if you'd sat on a fretful porpentine." I was quite wrong, of course. I doubt if he would do much more than raise an eyebrow, if when entering his pantry he found one of those peculiar fauna from the Book of Revelations in the sink. When he returned with the steaming pot, I unfolded my tale. He listened attentively, but gave no indication that he recognized that what he was listening to was rampage stuff. Only when I told him of the clicking of Orlo and Vanessa, releasing me from my honorable obligations to the latter, did a flicker of interest disturb his frozen features. I think he might have unbent to the extent of offering me respectful congratulations, had not Plank come bounding in. He was alone. I could have told him it was hopeless to try to get hold of the Maiden Eggespert police force at that time of the day. There was only one of it, and in the morning he does his rounds on his bicycle. Seeing Jeeves, he registered astonishment.
"Inspector Witherspoon,"
he cried.
"Amazing how you Scotland Yard fellows always get your man. I suppose you've been on Alpine Joe's trail for weeks, like a stoat on a rabbit." Little did he know that Inspector Witherspoon, the man who never sleeps, was watching his every move. Well, you couldn't have come up with him at a better moment, for in addition to whatever the police want him for, he has stolen a valuable cat belonging to my friend Cook. We caught him red-handed, or as red-handed as it is possible to be when stealing cats. But I'm surprised you should have untied him from the sofa. I always thought the one thing the police were fussy about was the necessity of leaving everything untouched.
I must say, I was what is called at a loss for words, but luckily Jeeves had plenty.
"I fail to understand you, sir,"
he said, his voice and manner so chilly that Plank must have been wishing he was wearing his winter woolies.
"And I may ask you why you address me as Inspector Witherspoon. I am not Inspector Witherspoon."
Plank clicked his tongue impatiently.
"Of course you are. I remember you distinctly. You'll be telling me next you didn't arrest this man at my place in Gloucestershire for trying to obtain £5 from me under false pretenses."
Jeeves had no irreproachable Mechlin lace at his wrist, or he would have unquestionably have flicked a speck of dust off it. He increased the coldness of his manner.
"You are mistaken in every respect, sir. Mr. Worcester has ample means. It seems scarcely likely, therefore, he would have attempted to obtain a mere £5 from you. I can speak with authority as to Mr. Worcester's financial standing, for I am his solicitor, and prepare his annual income tax return."
"So there you are, Plank," I said. "Must be obvious to every thinking man that you've been having hallucinations, possibly the result of getting a touch of the sun while making a pest of yourself to the natives of Equatorial Africa. If I were you, I'd pop straight back to E.J. Murgatroyd
and have him give you something for it. You don't want that sort of thing to spread. You'll look silly if it goes too far and we have to bury you before sundown." Plank was plainly shaken. He could not pale beneath his tan because he had so much tan that it was impossible to pale beneath it. I'm not sure I have put that exactly right. What I mean is, he may have paled, but you couldn't see it because of his sunburn. But he was looking very thoughtful, and I knew what was passing in his mind. He was wondering how he was going to explain to Cook, whom by tying people to sofas he had rendered liable for heavy damages for assault and battery and all sorts of things. His African explorers think quick. It took him 5 seconds flat to decide not to stay and explain to Cook. He was out of the room in a flash, his destination presumably Bongo on the Congo, or somewhere similar where the arm of the law couldn't touch him. I don't suppose he had shown a brisker turn of speed since the last time he had thought the natives seemed friendly and had decided to stay the night, only to have them come after him with spears. My first move after he had left us was, of course, to pay a marked tribute to Jeeves for his services and cooperation. This done, we struck the more social note. "Did you have a good time last night, Jeeves?"
"Extremely enjoyable, thank you, sir."
"How was your aunt?"
"At first somewhat dispirited."
"Why was that?"
"She has lost her cat, sir. On leaving for her holiday, she placed it in the charge of a friend, and it had strayed."
I gasped! A sudden idea had struck me. We Worcesters are like that. We are always getting struck by sudden ideas. Jeeves, could it be? Do you think it's possible?
"Yes, sir. She described the animal to me in minute detail, and there can be no doubt it is the one now in residence at Eggeswood Court."
I danced a carefree dance step. I know a happy ending when I see one. "Then we've got Cook cold."
"So it would seem, sir."
"We go to him and tell him he can carry on, plus cat, till the race is over, paying, of course, a suitable sum to your aunt. Lend-lease, isn't it called?"
"Yes, sir."
"And in addition, we make it a proviso. It is a proviso, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then he gives Orlo Porter his money. I'd like to see Orlo fixed up. He can't refuse, because he must have the cat, and if he tries any nolle prosequis as regard to Orlo, we slap an assault and battery suit on him. Am I right, Jeeves?"
"Indubitably, sir."
"And another thing. I have thought for some time that the hectic Russian swirl of life in Maiden Eggeswood can scarcely be what E. Jimson Murgatroyd had in mind when he sent me to the country to get a complete rest. What I need is something quieter, more peaceful, as it might be in New York. And if I'm mugged, what of it? It's probably all right, getting mugged, when you're used to it. Don't you agree, Jeeves?"
"Yes, sir."
"Are you in favor of bearding Pop Cook?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then let's go. My car is outside. Next stop, Eggeswood Court."
Chapter 20.
It was about a week after we had arrived in New York that, coming to the breakfast table one morning, rejoicing in my youth, if I remember rightly, I found a letter with an English stamp lying on my plate. Not recognizing the writing, I pushed it aside, intending to get at it later, after I had fortified myself with a square meal. I generally do this with the letters I get at breakfast time, because if they're stinkers and you read them on an empty stomach, you start your day all wrong. And in these disturbed times, you don't often find people writing anything but stinkers. Some half an hour later, refreshed and strengthened, I opened the envelope, and no wonder the writing had seemed familiar, for it was from Uncle Tom, and he hadn't written to me since I was at my private school. When, to do him credit, he had always enclosed a postal order for 5 or 10 bob. He hauled up his slacks thus.
"Dear Bertie, you will doubtless be surprised at hearing from me. I am writing for your aunt, who has met with an unfortunate accident and is compelled to wear her arm in a sling. This occurred during the concluding days of her visit to some friends of hers in Somerset named Briscoe. If I understand her rightly, a party was in progress to celebrate the victory of Colonel Briscoe's horse, Simla, in an important race, and a cork extracted from a bottle of champagne struck her so sharply on the tip of the nose she lost her balance and fell, injuring her wrist."
Then came 3 pages about the weather, the income tax, which he dislikes, and the recent purchases he had made for his collection of old silver. Finally, a postscript.
"P.S. Your aunt asked me to enclose this newspaper clipping."
I couldn't find any newspaper clipping. I suppose he must have forgotten to enclose it. Ah, then I saw it lying on the floor. I picked it up. It was from the Brydmouth Argus.
with which is incorporated the Somerset Farmer and the South Country Intelligencer. The organ, if you remember, whose dramatic critic gave the old ancestor such a rave notice when she sang Every Nice Girl Loves a Sailor in Her Sailor Suit at the Maiden Eggersford Village Concert. It ran as follows. Jubilee Stakes Sensation. Judge's Decision. Yesterday the judges, Major Welch, Admiral Sharp, and Sir Everett Boot, after prolonged consideration, gave the decision to the Jubilee Stakes incident, which has led to so much controversy in Brynmouth-on-Sea sporting circles. The race was awarded to Colonel Briscoe's Simla. Bets will accordingly be settled in accordance with this fiat. Rumour whispers that large sums will change hands. Here I paused, for letter and clipping had given me much food for thought. Naturally it was, with the deepest concern, I pictured the tragic incident of Aunt Dahlia and the champagne cork. Something similar happened to me once during some rout or revelry at the Drones, and I can testify it calls for all that one has of fortitude. But against this must be set the fact that she had won a substantial chunk of money and would not be forced with the awful necessity of getting into Uncle Tom's ribs in order to keep the budget balanced. But this aspect of the matter ceased to enchain my interest. What I wanted was to probe the heart of the mystery that had presented itself. Apparently Cook's potato chip had finished first, but had been disqualified. Why? Bumping? That's usually what you get disqualified for. I read on. The facts will, of course, be fresh in the minds of our readers. Rounding into the straight, Simla and his rival were neck and neck, far ahead of the field, and it was plain that one of the two must be the ultimate winner. Nearing the finish, Simla took the lead and was a full length ahead, when a cat with black and white markings suddenly ran onto the course, causing him to shy and unseat his jockey. It was then discovered that the cat was the property of a Mr. Cook, and had actually been brought to the course in the horse's horse box. It was this that decided the judges, who, as we say yesterday, awarded the race to Colonel Briscoe's entrant. Sympathy has been expressed for Mr. Cook. Not by me, I hasten to say. I felt it served the old blighter jolly well right. He ought to have known that you can't go about the place for years making a hellhound of yourself without eventually paying the price. Remember what the fellow said about the mills of the gods. I was in a philosophical mood as I smoked the after-breakfast cigarette. Jeeves came in to clear away the debris, and I told him the news. Simla won, Jeeves.
Indeed, sir, that is most gratifying.
And Aunt Dahlia got hit on the tip of the nose with a champagne cork.
Sir?
At the subsequent celebrations at the Briscoe home.
Ah, yes, sir. A painful experience, but no doubt satisfaction at her financial gains would enable Mrs. Travers to bear it with fortitude. Was the tone of her communication cheerful?
The letter wasn't from her. It was from Uncle Tom. He enclosed this. I handed him the clipping, and I could see how deeply it interested him. One of his eyebrows rose at least a 1/16 of an inch. Dramatic, Jeeves.
Exceedingly, sir. But I am not sure I altogether agree with the verdict of the judges.
You don't?
I should have been inclined to regard the episode as an act of God.
Well, thank goodness the decision wasn't up to you. The imagination boggles at the thought of how Aunt Dahlia would have reacted if it had gone the other way. One pictures her putting hedgehogs in Major Welch's bed and getting 14 days without the option for pouring buckets of water out windows onto the heads of Admiral Sharp and Sir Everett Boot. I should have got nervous prostration in the first couple of days. And it was difficult enough to avoid nervous prostration in Maiden Eggersford as it was, Jeeves, I said, my philosophical mood now buzzing along on all 12 cylinders. Do you ever brood on life?
Occasionally, sir, when at leisure.
What do you make of it? Pretty odd in spots, don't you think?
It might be so described, sir.
This business of such and such seeming to be so and so, when it really isn't so and so at all. You follow me?
Not entirely, sir.
Well, take a simple instance. At first sight, Maiden Eggersford had all the indications of being a haven of peace. You agree with me?
Yes, sir.
As calm and quiet as you could wish, with honeysuckle cottages and apple-cheeked villages wherever you looked. Then it tore off its whiskers and revealed itself as an inferno. To obtain calm and quiet, we had to come to New York. And there you got full measure. Life saunters along on an even keel. Nothing happens. Have we been mugged?
No, sir.
Or shot by youths?
No, sir.
No, sir is right. We're tranquil, and I'll tell you why. There are no aunts here, and in particular, we are 3,000 miles away from Mrs. Dahlia Travers of Brinkley Manor, Mockett Snodsbury, Worcestershire. Don't get me wrong, Jeeves. I love the old flesh and blood. In fact, I revere her. Nobody can say she is good company. But her moral code is lax. She cannot distinguish between what is according to Hoyle and what is not according to Hoyle. If she wants to do anything, she doesn't ask herself, would Emily Post approve of this? She just goes ahead and does it, as she did in this matter of the cat. Jeeves, do you know what the trouble with aunts is as a class?
No, sir.
They're not gentlemen, I said gravely. The end.
We hope that you've enjoyed this Uvula audio presentation of Aunts Aren't Gentlemen by P.G. Wodehouse. Your narrator has been Jim Campanella. The opening and closing themes were written by BBC composer Nigel Hess and again repurposed here to great success. Please feel free to write us and tell us what you think at uvulaaudio@uvulaaudio.com. You can also become a Facebook fan of Uvula Audio. Just do a search for Uvula Audio on Facebook or do it from the main Uvula Audio webpage. As usual, check out our Cafe Press website for t-shirts, etc. For other Uvula Audio titles, please go to our website at www.uvulaaudio.com. We are listed on iTunes, and you can subscribe and download our podcasts for free from there. If you like our podcasts, please feel free to tip us whatever amount you may like using the secure PayPal links at uvulaaudio.com. Lester Dent's novels have been the most popular stories on the Uvula Audio website for the last several years. The only author more popular has been H.P. Lovecraft. Well, due to the huge demand by our listeners, we will be returning to the pulp universe of Lester Dent and Doc Savage for the first time in a couple of years. Uvula Audio will next be presenting the classic pulp novel Murder Melody. Murder Melody marks the debut of Doc Savage ghostwriter Lawrence Donovan, who wrote 9 Doc novels during this period. Although Donovan had a good handle on the concept and the characters of the series, his Doc stories are quite different from Dent's. Donovan went for more of a blockbuster action type of epic on a scale even grander than Dent's. I have heard Donovan described as the Michael Bay of his time. That is, big, loud, flashy, and dumb. This does not take away from Murder Melody, however, and Doc Savage fans seem to hate or love this story in equal numbers. We think that you will find Murder Melody an interesting alternative to Lester Dent's slightly more prosaic novels. From all of us at Uvula Audio, we thank you.